Well, the Mean Gene Report this week, since the networks will be trying to capture the sweeps, ABC is releasing War in Remembrance, which started tonight. I think I want to talk about the crime and punishment of I.G. Farben by Joseph Borkin as a means of highlighting abuse at high levels. In the preface, the author says, Now, I'll get back to the Lost Tribe, but I just want to say something about this. My first encounter with IG, Farben Industry, Aktiengesellschaft, took place in the early summer of 1934. This is the author talking. I had just been hired by the United States Special Senate Committee to investigate the munitions industry as an investigative researcher. By luck, my immediate supervisor was H.C. Engelbrecht, whose book Merchants of Death had been an important factor influencing Senator Gerald P. Nye to press for the investigation. To ease me into the job, Engelbrecht handed me an agreement between Standard Oil Company, New Jersey, and I.G. Farben. My assignment was to summarize this involved contract so that it would be intelligible to the senators on the committee. I had never heard of I.G. Farben before, as some of you listening to me have never heard of it. It was 10 years ago on television when I last brought this subject up. And a lot of you weren't listening then. I'd never heard of I.G. Farben before. But for the next 44 years, it was my Moby Dick. After the Senate committee, I took I.G. Farben along with me to the Committee on Patents of the House of Representatives, where I served as a technical counsel on patent pooling and cross-licensing agreements. In 1938, I carted my industrial white whale to the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice. There, as head of the Patent and Cartel Section, under Thurman Arnold, I instituted the cartel program in which the attack against I.G. Farben continued throughout the course of World War II. In 1943, I co-authored Germany's Master Plan, a book outlining the details of this program. After the war, when I read the transcript of the trial of the I.G. war criminals at Nuremberg, I knew that someday I would write the present book. Without I.G. Farben's immense productive facilities, its far-reaching research, varied technical experience, and overall concentration of economic power, Germany would not have been in a position to start its aggressive war in September 1939. Such was the judgment rendered by a team of civilian and military experts assigned by General Eisenhower at the close of World War II to make an exhaustive investigation of IG's contribution to the Nazi war effort. Extravagant as this conclusion may have sounded, the record sustains its accuracy. I.G. Farben truly was a mighty industrial colossus. So huge were its assets admitted and concealed. So superior is technological know-how and so formidable its array of patents that it dominated the chemical business of the world. IG fortified this commercial leadership by constructing a maze of cartels whose members included such industrial giants as Kuhlmann of France, Imperial Chemical Industries of Great Britain, Montecatini of Italy, Osiger Veren of Czechoslovakia, Baruta of Poland, Mitsui of Japan, and Standard Oil, New Jersey, DuPont, and Dow Chemical of the United States. But IG was more than a corporate empire. Through the uncanny talents of its scientists and engineers, it secured the vital self-sufficiency that enabled Germany to maneuver in the world of power politics. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
From its laboratories and factories flowed the strategic raw materials that Germany's own territory could not supply. The synthetics of oil. Anybody ever stand in line in the manufactured oil crisis? The synthetics of oil. Gasoline from coal, which we have enough of to be self-sufficient. The synthetics of oil, rubber, nitrates, and fibers. So, too, IG produced vaccines, sera, and drugs such as salvarsan, aspirin, atabrine, and novocaine, along with sulfur drugs as well as poison gas and rocket fuels. Few universities could match the profusion of Nobel Prizes earned by its scientists. Paul Ehrlich for salvarsan, Fritz Haber for the fixation of nitrogen, Carl Bosch for synthesizing saltpeter and gasoline, and Gerhard de Mock for the sulfur drugs. Gustav Stresemann, Chancellor and Foreign Minister during the Weimar Republic, once said, quote, without IG and coal, I can have no foreign policy. But it was for the Nazis that IG performed the greatest service. With IG and coal, Adolf Hitler almost conquered the world. How many of you saw the movie The Formula? Hollywoodized, as they always are. It was based upon some of the data in this book, or at least the data from which this book is built. Hitler was an apt student of the weaknesses that brought Germany to its knees during World War I. Defeat had drilled into him the doleful fact that Germany's impoverished land, devoid of the strategic raw materials with which modern wars are fought, had made the British blockade a decisive weapon. So in planning for World War II, he vowed to correct nature's imbalance with science and technology. The result was a strange alliance between Hitler and IG. Hitler despised IG for its international complexion and for its unusually large number of Jewish directors and scientists. Carl Bosch, the head of IG when Hitler came to power, was the most vocal anti-Nazi in the industrial community. In the light of succeeding events, it is ironic that the Nazis legally stigmatized IG as non-Aryan in the early years of the Third Reich. But Hitler needed IG's genius, and IG needed Hitler's support. IG's first and major task for Hitler was to free German diplomacy from the bonds that shackled it to the oil wells and rubber groves of its enemies. How well it succeeded is written in the history of the world's most violent and mechanized war. As you watch War and Remembrance, remember, Hitler didn't get his oil from the Arabs, didn't run his tanks and his planes with oil from the Dutch East Indies, Malaysia, and surroundings, the Arab nations, or Iran. He didn't even have an Alaska pipeline. The first and major task for Hitler was to free German diplomacy from the bonds that shackled it to the oil wells and rubber groves of its enemies. Otherwise, he could win no war. How well he succeeded is written in the history of the world's most violent and mechanized war. For 5.5 years, Hitler's tanks, trucks, and planes were propelled by IG's gasoline. Their wheels made of IG's rubber. Synthetic rubber. Success had rendered IG indispensable. Mere indispensability, however, was not enough. As the war progressed, IG's embrace of Hitler became more passionate. With the help of the Wehrmacht and the Nazi bureaucracy, IG looted the chemical properties of the defeated nations, Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Norway, and France. Moreover, it had similar plans to bring England, the United States, and the Soviet Union into its orbit. IG's moral descent did not end there. But before long, it joined the Nazis in a vast forced labor program in which millions of victims from the conquered countries were enslaved in the service of German war production. But slavery was only a step in the dehumanization of victor and vanquished. IG found itself in the role of an industrial force, unable and unwilling to extricate itself from the compact it had made with Hitler to help prepare the Nazis for war. The depth of that partnership was reached at Auschwitz, the extermination center, where 4 million human beings were destroyed in accordance with the final solution of the Jewish question. Hitler's plan to destroy an entire people, the Jew, and the gypsies sucked in, and other undesirables, as he viewed them. Drawn by the almost limitless reservoir of death camp labor, IG chose to build a great industrial complex at Auschwitz for the production of synthetic rubber and oil. So enormous was this installation that it used as much electricity as did the entire city of Berlin. More than 25,000 camp inmates paid with their lives to construct it. Now, if you watch War and Remembrance and see it focus on Auschwitz, they probably will not show Nobel Prize winners a stone's throw from the camp, relatively, toasting with champagne, meeting their production quotas on the blood and flesh of the slave labor at Auschwitz. And they probably won't talk of the hypocrisy and bribery at high government levels in the United States and the compacts between Standard Oil and IG Farben. Because only preachers, in the view of the media, need to be supervised. You want me to continue? Get on telephone. Now, our East Coast listeners have already seen War and Remembrance. Tonight's version, my remarks about watching it were to the West Coast viewers. I'm reading from The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben by Joseph Borkin. Give you a little broader color behind the scenes you'll see at Auschwitz in War and Remembrance. After the defeat of Germany in World War II, the horror of IG Auschwitz made it certain that those involved would have to face the consequences of their acts. An indictment charging 24 of IG's highest officials with war crimes was filed with the United States Military Tribunal at Nuremberg. In the opening paragraph of his statement to the court, General Telford Taylor, the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg, summarized the spirit of the prosecution's case. Quote, "The grave charges in this case have not been laid before the tribunal casually or unreflectingly. The indictment accuses these men of major responsibility for visiting upon mankind the most searing and catastrophic war in human history. It accuses them of wholesale enslavement, plunder, and murder. These are terrible charges. No man should underwrite them frivolously or vengefully, or without deep and humble awareness of the responsibility which he thereby shoulders. There's no laughter in this case, neither is there any hate." End quote. Yet, despite the terrible gravity of the charges, the setting was more like that for an antitrust suit than that for a trial for slavery and mass murder, as the defendants took their places in the dock at the Palace of Justice at Nuremberg. The 23 defendants, the 24th, Max Brueggemann, excused for illness, were among the industrial elite of Germany. Not Hitler's black and brown shirted hooligans. They represented a combination of scientific genius and commercial acumen unique in a private industrial enterprise. They were the executives who made IG preeminent in the world of technology and commerce. They served on the boards of directors of the most prestigious corporations in their own country and abroad, where they were treated with awe and admiration. When their government called, they accepted official posts in the spirit of public service. Like their counterparts everywhere, they were among the leading supporters of culture, charity, and religion, donating their names, time, and money. And as I said at the close of the previous half hour, as you watch the scenes at Auschwitz in War and Remembrance, you probably will not be aware that Auschwitz fed IG's production quotas as they fueled the war machine of Germany. And Nobel Prize winners, no less, would be toasting the reaching of their quotas in cocktail parties within shouting distance of the slave camp and the dying at Auschwitz. A story the news media won't tell you. Of bribery in high places in the United States and hookups between Standard Oil, New Jersey. Rockefeller's toy. And this industrial chemical complex, IG Farben. And the deliberate decisions to hold from the American public the knowledge of synthetic oil and synthetic rubber until the oil supplies reached a stage where their profit through the use of that oil as long as it lasted could continue to churn out. Then the synthetics could be revealed. Corruption in high places. Of course, news media, being the simple-minded people they are, would have us believe that America will collapse over Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart. I don't intend to spend the whole evening on this. I'd like to teach on the lost tribe. We have a job to do, which is raise the budget for November. And those of you, while I try to get the rest of this cigar out of my mouth, that support, get on the telephone, tell me what you're doing this week, coming up, and for the rest of the month of November. In a disgraceful record of American history, pushing clear up into the days of President Kennedy, with the interests of those who sought to return the holdings of IG Farben to IG Farben after the war, those interests being represented by Prince Roosevelt himself, connected to the Kennedy family, and with some behind-the-scenes action by Joseph Kennedy, the father of the Kennedy clan, deception on the American public continued through the First World War, clear up to and including the activities in the days of the Kennedys. IG Farben, the great chemical company with more Nobel Prize winners than major universities, wed to Hitler's war effort, drawing up master plans for the gobbling up of chemical concerns in the conquered countries as Hitler blitzkrieged across Europe. At a meeting in The Hague, 2 days before the Japanese dropped their bombs on Pearl Harbor, drew up a memorandum to deceive the American public and the American government by an alleged transfer of the holdings, including the patents of IG Farben, to subsidiaries of Standard Oil of New Jersey, which in all the cases that proceeded through many years was shown to be nothing but a camouflage, recognizing that as war broke out, and particularly when the United States entered into the war, IG Farben, fueling with synthetic rubber and synthetic gasoline, the war machine of Hitler, gobbling up the chemical countries of the conquered nations in Europe, or the Kenya, all of them, assets, raw materials, and companies. Knowing that as war broke out, the government could seize, allied governments could seize the property held by IG Farben, a company of Nazi Germany, in interconnected agreements, sham agreements, concluded in court many times, I.G. Farben transferred the control of its interlocking foreign countries in order to give what appeared to be a non-enemy country alien ownership of those patents and thus block American seizure of that vital information. And this subterfuge on the American government, including a $50,000 bribe to the Attorney General of the United States, as far back as President Harding, continued through the war and right up to the Kennedy administration. The focus and the reason for bringing this up and reading from this book, The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, is the interest in the war years created by the monumental and credible work of War and Remembrance that is pouring out of the TV this week. Herman Walk's great work, a sequel to The Winds of War. You'll see Auschwitz. You won't, probably, even in the 18-hour grand coverage, see much of this. And again, I get on these subjects just to ridicule the media and its frothy, two-bit, throwaway grocery store paper coverage, particularly the television news, of events that influence America. Too hot in here, Mike. I have no use for Jim Baker. I fired him and spoke publicly about what he was doing 13 years ago off this network. I was naming Jimmy Swaggart for what he was before the news media ever mentioned his name, and while they were touting him as the number one. But I'm sick and tired of the way they have been able to play off of these two little two-bit affairs to intimidate and place religious representatives on the defensive, and their blatant attempt to drive any voice for God off television to be replaced by their marvelous, benevolent, fascistic, know what's best for you dictatorship of the airwaves. When stories like this are laying around all the time, that's the purpose of the Mean Gene Review. While they were fawning on the Pope, which is the only religion the media seems to accept, you ought to figure out why. They're big, and they're powerful, and they're rich. Which means that the people that I teach would simply do what God's Word says. No more, no less. Pay the Lord's tithe, which is not yours anyway, to the table where you get your spiritual food, the storehouse you eat from spiritually. At least my voice would remain the alternative to the garbage that's being peddled on the airwaves. I told you a long time ago, as we prepare for the last days, this may be the last free voice, and it'll last as long as you keep it strong and powerful. And all you've got to do is do what God told you to do. Pay your tithe where you eat your spiritual food. When the Pope was here, I was talking about the murder of the Pope and the scandal of the Vatican Bank. About all you're going to get about the mafia connection to the Kennedy assassination is the overkill, shoddily done, Jack Anderson program. And as the winds of war are followed by this sequel, War and Remembrance, I want to take a little time to point out this festering sore that managed to persevere through the war and after the war, clear up to the Kennedys, and is doing fine right now. And nobody anywhere is examining it. And just maybe the biggest bombshell I'll drop in the Mean Gene Review is a question one of these days when the time hits me, why Koppel and the rest of the ABC crowd don't do some probing about the people whose signatures appear on their check. And about the company that grew from that little piddling Mary Carter Paint Company. Into a sore of leprosy compared to the little pimple on American society that Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart represent. Their so-called allegiance to the public's right to know shows tremendous lack of gonads where it counts. Or just plain guts in reporting. I do not see it very heroic of the media to tromp on Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart as though they're saving America from imminent destruction. Here are the kind of stories they stay away from. Next door to I.G. Farben's productive plant where Nobel Prize winners would toast the reaching of their quotas was Auschwitz. At Nuremberg, some of the testimony told what went on there, and I won't bore you with it. You'll see enough in War and Remembrance. Of all the people employed in IG Auschwitz, notice IG Auschwitz, this was the answer for slave labor in IG Farben's great industrial work. The inmates received the worst treatment. They were beaten by the capos, who in their turn had to see to it that the amount of work prescribed them and their detachments by the IG foreman were carried out, because they otherwise were punished by being beaten in the evening at the Monowitz camp. Remember that Monowitz name? A general driving system prevailed on the IG construction site so that one cannot say that the capos alone were to blame. The capos drove the inmates and their detachments exceedingly hard in self-defense, so to speak, and did not shrink from using any means of increasing the work of the inmates just so long as the amount of work required was done. Hardly less compelling was the testimony of the Secretary of IG Managing Board, Ernest A. Struss. I mean, you keep hearing about Auschwitz, and you get the impression this was Nazi SS work alone. secretary of the IG Managing Board. Ernest A. Strauss, who had visited IG Auschwitz several times, counsel. The chief engineer of the Buna plant, with whom you spoke in 1943, did he specifically tell you that people were being burned at Auschwitz? Strauss. Yes, I think he also told me that before the burning they were gassed. Counsel. And in the summer of 1943, you knew that people were being burned and gassed? Strauss. Secretary of the IG Managing Board. Yes. Counsel. And to your best recollection, you told that to Ambrose and Termeer? Heads of the company? Strauss. Yes. Through former Auschwitz inmates, the prosecution presented a graphic picture of conditions at IG Auschwitz and Monowitz. Typical was the testimony of Robert Eli Vates, a professor at the University of Strasbourg, an inmate who was also a physician with an international reputation. He worked in the Monowitz Hospital and because of his renown and demeanor was a forceful witness. Quote, I found out very soon that Monowitz was an extermination camp. On account of the severe living conditions, the prisoners were exposed to that slow process of physical and mental dissolution which terminated, in most cases, in the gas chamber. The final aim was unmistakable. The dehumanization and eventual extermination of the prisoners employed in the IG plant at Auschwitz was the result. I heard an SS officer at Monowitz saying to the prisoners, subquote, you are all condemned to die, but the execution of your sentence will take a little while. Until that time, the SS and IG in common exploited the prisoners beyond what they could bear. From witness Rudolf Vitek, also both a physician and an inmate, came the following appraisal. Quote, the prisoners were pushed in their work by the capos, foremen, and overseers of the IG in an inhuman way. No mercy was shown. Thrashings, ill treatment of the worst kind, even direct killings were the fashion. The murderous working speed was responsible for the fact that while working, many prisoners suddenly stretched out flat, turned blue, gasped for breath, and died like beasts. It was no rare occurrence that detachments of 400 to 500 men brought back with them in the evening 5 to 20 corpses. The dead were brought to the place of roll call and counted as being present. A Czechoslovakian inmate swore, quote, the directors of IG Farben knew about the selection. The employees of IG Farben indirectly occasioned the selections. The master craftsman complained to the management, and from there the complaints were forwarded to the management, Dr. Derfeld, and from there to the SS. Consequently, the labor allocation officer in Auschwitz went to Monowitz early in the morning when the squads left for work, posted himself near the gate, and picked out those people whom they considered sickly. These people were sent to the gas chambers straight away. Those written complaints I myself have seen. Very dramatic was the appearance for the prosecution of a group of British prisoners of war. Their testimony was especially impressive. Quote, the condition of the concentration camp inmates was deplorable. I used to see them being carried back at night dead from exposure, hunger, or exhaustion. The concentration camp inmates did heavy manual labor, such as carrying steel girders, pipes, cables, bricks, and sacks of cement weighing about 100 pounds. As a rule, the inmates weighed less than the cement sacks. I have seen the inmates shuffle, trying to make it in double time, but unable to do it, and I've seen them collapse. We would see the chaps hanging up in the gate of Lager 4, and the prisoners had to walk underneath them. I saw those bodies myself. Working parties passed under the gate while walking to work. Cross-examination did not help the defendant's case. Question, did you see personally how prisoners were hanged in Camp 4 at Monowitz? Answer, I saw three men hanging in the gate of Camp 4 approximately in February 1944. Question, do you know why these prisoners were hanged? Answer, I didn't know there had to be a reason. Another British prisoner of war testified, quote, I was at Auschwitz nearly every day. The population of Auschwitz was fully aware that people were being gassed and burned. On one occasion, they complained about the stench of burning bodies. Of course, all the Farben people knew what was going on. Nobody could live in Auschwitz and work in the plant or even come down to the plant without knowing what was common knowledge to everybody. I warn you. In August 1942, I'm going to catalog I.G. Farben quickly. Sink into the dregs of their alliance with the Nazis, because it was I.G. Farben itself that built the Monowitz camp to supply its slave labor. Starvation, one more description. Starvation was a permanent guest at Auschwitz. The diet fed to IG Auschwitz inmates, which included the famous Buna soup, a nutritional aid not available to other prisoners, resulted in an average weight loss for each individual of about 6.5 to 9 pounds a week. At the end of a month, the change in the prisoner's appearance was marked. At the end of 2 months, the inmates were not recognizable except as caricatures formed of skin, bones, and practically no flesh. After 3 months, they were either dead or so unfit for work that they were marked for release to the gas chambers at Birkenau. Two physicians who studied the effect of the IG diet on the inmates noticed that, quote, the normally nourished prisoner at Buna could make up the deficiency by his own body for a period of 3 months. They were experimenting with this. The prisoners were condemned to burn up their own body weight while working, and providing no infections occurred, finally died of exhaustion. As for each shelter at Monowitz, the inmates slept in three tiers of wooden cubicles. Each slot, barely large enough for one person to lie down, actually held three. An eyewitness reported, as a result, it was practically impossible to sleep, since if one man was in a reclining position, the others would have to sit up or lie over him. The simplest comforts were denied. Tables and chairs were almost unknown. Hygienic conditions were subhuman. In the summer, the heat was oppressive, almost beyond endurance. In the winter, there was no heat at all. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
You're on telephone. As you watch War and Remembrance, you'll get the impression, I'm sure, that it was Nazi SS responsible for all the concentration slave labor camps. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I'll be very surprised if War and Remembrance details the complicity of I.G. Farben and its connections with Standard Oil of New Jersey, and the participation of Nobel Prize winners, many of whom were later indicted and convicted at Nuremberg, in the gobbling up by pre-planned rapacity the great chemical concerns of Europe, and the fact that without I.G. Farben, the war could not have been fought. With their scientific genius of producing synthetic rubber, synthetic gasoline, the war machine of Hitler was supplied by these brilliant scientists and industrial leaders. They came to Nuremberg, but that didn't finish the story. And they came to Nuremberg because as they descended into the devil's chemist role, they built and utilized that terrible camp. You can sit down, all of you. Auschwitz, with its slave labor. I'm reading from The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. In July 1942, just after Hitler begun his second year of troubles in the Soviet Union, the I.G. Farben Managing Board voted to solve its Auschwitz labor problems by establishing its own concentration camp. The initial appropriation was 5 million Reichsmarks, a modest amount to protect its investment of almost a billion Reichsmarks. For a private company to set up its own concentration camp to ensure a supply of labor may have been an odd undertaking. But the problem called for imagination and audacity, especially since the size of the investment and the certain consequences of Hitler's wrath made abandonment of the project unrealistic. The managing board of directors of I.G. Farben, without any recorded opposition, felt that economically and politically, I.G. had no other choice. On the other hand, under the circumstances, an I.G. concentration camp had the obvious advantage to recommend it. Inmates would not be drained of their already limited energy by the long marches from the main concentration camp to the construction site. Security would improve and fewer of the scarce SS guards would be required. Discipline and punishment would be more effective. And I.G. Farben itself would also have greater and more immediate control over the use of the inmates. Of no small consequence, costs would be reduced. The site chosen for I.G.'s own concentration camp was called Monowitz. In the operation of this unique facility, I.G. was to be responsible for the housing, feeding, and health of the inmates. The SS was charged with the security, punishment, and supply of inmates. Monowitz was completed in the summer of 1942. Although it belonged to I.G. Farben, Monowitz had all the equipment of typical Nazi concentration camp. Watchtowers with searchlights, warning sirens, poised machine guns, armed guards, and trained police dogs. The entire camp was encircled with electrically charged barbed wire. There was a standing cell in which the victim could neither stand upright, kneel, nor lie down. There was also a gallows, often with a body or two hanging from it, as a grim example to the rest of the inmates. Across the arched entrance was the Auschwitz motto. You'll see it many times in war and remembrance. Work makes you free. In the administration of Monowitz, I.G. Farben, the SS, adopted the principle enunciated by Fritz Sauckel plenipotentiary for labor allocation of the four-year plan. Quote, all the inmates must be fed, sheltered, and treated in such a way as to exploit them to the highest possible extent at the least conceivable degree of expenditure. The complete Auschwitz installation was now comprised of four entities. Auschwitz I, the original and vast concentration camp with hundreds of thousands of inmates. Auschwitz II, the extermination center of gassing chambers and crematory ovens at Birkenau. Auschwitz III, the IG Buna and synthetic fuel works. Also, an output of IG Farben and a subsidiary. And Auschwitz IV, IG Farben's own concentration camp at Monowitz. When IG Farben took its place in the industrial labor complex of Auschwitz and accepted Himmler's offer of concentration camp labor, it embarked on a road to Koldenmuir, embarked on a road that led ultimately to participation in the most extraordinary crime in civilized history. What Winston Churchill called the crime for which there is no name. The so-called final solution of the Jewish question. To meet the construction schedule, the IG management worked the inmates at an almost murderous pace. It adopted, for example, IG Farben did this, the SS trot as a work tempo so that even cement and other heavy construction material were carried to the job at double time. IG plant police and foremen as well as capos continuously threatened and thrashed the prisoners who did not work up to SS standards. At times, the inmates were literally worked to death. It was no rare occurrence that detachments of 400 to 500 men brought back with them in the evening 5 to 20 corpses. Two or three times a week, those who died on the site and those from whom all useful life had been extracted were piled on open platforms for all to see and trucked to Birkenau. The gas chambers and the ovens. For the inmate laborer, it was a useful reminder employed effectively by IG foremen and SS guards. The construction of IG Auschwitz has assured IG Farben a unique place in business history. By adopting the theory and practice of Nazi morality, it was able to depart from the conventional economics of slavery itself, in which slaves are traditionally treated as capital equipment to be maintained and serviced for optimum use and appreciated over a normal lifespan. Instead, IG Farben reduced slave labor to a consumable raw material, a human ore from which the mineral of life was systematically extracted. When no usable energy remained, the living dross was shipped to the gassing chambers and cremation furnaces of the extermination center at Birkenau, where the SS recycled it into the German war economy, gold teeth for the Reichsbank, hair for mattresses, and fat for soap. Even the moans of the doomed were recorded to become a work incentive, exhorting the remaining inmates to greater effort. This is IG Farben's own camp. Corporate camouflage, the art of concealing foreign properties from enemy governments, has a special place in the history of IG. Unlike IG's involvement in mass murder and slave labor, which was a wartime aberration, IG Farben's program of camouflage long predated and outlived the war. Its political effects will persist for years to come. True November 1988. Because IG's corporate camouflage was conceived and conducted in secrecy, its details largely escaped the prosecutors in Nuremberg. They go back many, many years. Before a grand jury, the former Attorney General of the United States, Harry Dougherty, was called. When asked questions involving this complicity of camouflage, he answered, and regarding a $50,000 bribe, Attorney General of the United States, no less, here's his answer. Now, all the attorney generals in America have not been attacked by the press because of this dog. You notice that? Here's his answer. Having been personal attorney for Warren C. Harding before he was senator from Ohio and while he was senator and thereafter until his death, and for Mrs. Harding for a period of several years and before her husband was elected president and after his death, and having been attorney for the Midland National Bank of Washington Courthouse, Ohio, and for my brother M.S. Dougherty, and having been Attorney General of the United States during the time that President Harding served as president, and also for a time after President Harding's death under President Coolidge, and with all those named as attorney, personal friend, and attorney general, my relations were of the most confidential character as well as professional. I refused to testify and answer questions put to me because, quote, the answer I might give or make and the testimony I might give might tend to incriminate me. Attorney General of the United States on inquiries about a $50,000 bribe. And the effects of this complicity is still going on. But the news media thinks this isn't important. We should be beat to death over a 7-year-old, 14-minute affair with Jim Baker. Constantly be exposed to the silicone expansions of the girl he was with. Because the public has a right to know. After the war, or rather, as the war approached its last year. Now, let me try to summarize so I can bring this to a little bit of a close. 2 days before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, I.G. Farben of Germany, who had gobbled up the major chemical countries of the conquered or chemical companies of the conquered nations. But prior to the war, dating before the First World War, when these major companies formed their community of interest cartel, and having interconnecting relationships with Standard Oil of New Jersey, primarily, and its subsidiaries and some other countries, other companies in this country, they begin to worry as they saw the imminent entry, and one wonders what they knew to make this agreement 2 days before Pearl Harbor was bombed. They worked out by memo in The Hague an agreement to sell and dispose of its shares of companies in America and England and other allied nations that could be seized if held in the name of I.G. Farben, the enemy company. The gentleman representing the American side of this agreement in The Hague had to consider the possibility of repercussions if he met in The Hague with a representative of I.G. Farben from a country at war with England. He received his permission, therefore, from Jack Kennedy's father, Joseph Kennedy, then acting as ambassador to the court of St. James. And when the matter was resolved in the days of John F. Kennedy's presidency, as properties sucked back into the control of I.G. Farben, who still continues, again Joseph Kennedy played a part. But as the war approaches last year, Standard Oil of New Jersey, who had become, through subsidiaries and companies it controlled, some of which will be named as I quickly read this, sought to ensure its control over those assets by trying to deny that it was but a camouflage to hold these properties until after the war for I.G. Farben. So as the war approached this last year, the problem what action should be taken became a serious question. Standard Oil New Jersey felt it could not afford the luxury of waiting for a climate of change. It had good reason to believe that Crowley, under pressure from the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, was about to issue licenses under the vested JASCO and Standard IG Company's patents, and it decided to take the bull by the horns. On July 13, 1944, Standard and its affiliates, Standard Oil Development Company, Standard Catalytic Company, and JASCO filed a complaint under Section 9A of the Trading with the Enemy Act against the alien property custodian of in U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. The companies charged that the patents and stock of the Standard IG Company and JASCO had been wrongfully seized and demanded their return because of the prosecution at Nuremberg and the unraveling of this sham transfer and the complicities that were involved because this memo was worked out in The Hague without the know-how of producing synthetic rubber, and 2 days later Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, and we had to go to war in our defensive position, as cataloged very well in War and Remembrance. If the Japanese had known how badly we were hurt, they might have conquered us. And we had to go to war with the loss through the Japanese conquering of all of those Dutch East Indies areas of rubber sources, and didn't have the knowledge that I.G. Farben had in this sham transfer of how to make synthetic rubber. Standard Oil demanded these patents that had been seized by the custodian, alien property custodian in U.S. District Court, saying that it was a sham for Standard Oil and its subsidiaries to hold them. They were just holding it for I.G. Farben. Standard Oil denied that and said that they were wrongfully seized because it wasn't alien property, it was theirs. And the trial began on May 21, 1945, 2 weeks after Germany surrendered unconditionally. Representing Standard was John W. Davis of the Davis-Polk firm. Davis, an eminent member of the American Bar, had been the Democratic nominee for President of the United States in 1924. Heading the trial team that represented the alien property custodian was Philip Amran, a trial lawyer from Philadelphia who had been drafted for the task by the Attorney General Biddle. Chief Justice Harlan Stone presided over the case, designated specially by the U.S. District Court in Boston. The chief contention of Standard's lawyers during the trial was that at the time the JASCO and Standard IG shares and patents were vested on March 25, 1942, Standard was their rightful and legal owner, and that all vestiges of IG's interest in the properties had disappeared in September 1939 with the Hague Agreement. The government's defense of the seizure was the transfer of the stock and patents to Standard as provided by the Hague Agreement was a camouflage to conceal the enemy ownership of IG. In the course of preparing for trial, Amran received word from the War Department that August von Canarium, chief legal counsel of IG in Germany, had been captured by General Patton's Third Army. Amran sensed that the approaching defeat of Hitler might make Canarium a cooperative witness. He caught the first available military plane for Paris, where Canarium was brought for the interrogation. You got the drama of this? The IG lawyer not only agreed to appear as a U.S. government witness, but also promised to provide documents in support of Amran's case. This would include papers involving the Hague Agreement as well as correspondence about the transactions between IG and the German High Command. All this material was intact because when the bombing of Frankfurt had begun, Canarium had moved all his files to a farm outside of Heidelberg, which as a protected university city had not been bombed by Allied air forces. Amran arranged for Canarium to bring these papers to New York for trial. When the trial was in its second week, Amran received word that Canarium had arrived at Ellis Island with his documents. Amran went to meet him, and Canarium said he was ready to testify. He asked Amran to do something for him first, however. Buy him a new white shirt and tie so he would not have to face his old Standard associates in a shabby prisoner of war uniform. Amran complied. Amran was now ready to unveil his mystery witness. He called Canarium to the witness stand. Wearing the new shirt and tie, Canarium entered the courtroom under military guard. He clicked his heels and bowed to the judge and the attorneys on both sides. The faces of the Standard Oil executives were something I'll never forget, Amran later recalled. Judge Wozanski asked Canarium if he would like a translator, but the German lawyer proudly declined. Now, Judge Wozanski of the U.S. District Court had been specially designated by Chief Justice Harlan Stone, a reverse of what I said earlier. Wozanski asked Canarium if he would like a translator, but the German lawyer proudly declined. Then, in clipped and impeccable English, with only a trace of an accent, he proceeded to identify the documents he had brought from Germany. Amran was now ready to deal Standard a devastating blow. He offered in evidence Canarium's own copy of the Hague Agreement, with the latter's handwritten notes in the margins, some in English and some in German. Beside the preamble, written at The Hague, stating that under the original 1930 agreement, Jasko was the owner of certain patent rights, including the Buna process, Canarium had written, Nachkrieg Kamuflage, post-war camouflage. Amram then introduced correspondence that Canarium had supplied between IG and the High Command. In one document, IG explained, quote, by this transfer, the patents in German possession will be removed from enemy seizure. We consider it right to transfer the patents to an American holder who is on friendly terms with us and who will cooperate with us on a friendly basis in the future. Standard Oil, New Jersey, their subsidiary, Jasko, while we were going through the war, and IG was running Monowitz. After strong objections by the Standard lawyer, Judge Weiss, Zansky finally admitted Canarium's documents. In Amram's view, this evidence, quote, exposed the falsity of the Hague Memorandum and showed conclusively that the whole scheme was a transparent device to conceal the property from the alien property custodian in the event of United States participation in World War II. 5 months later, on November 7, 1945, Judge Wozanski rendered his verdict. He held that all transfers of assets from IG to Standard after the Hague Agreement were a sham designed to create the false appearance of Standard ownership of property interests that both parties continued to regard as owned by IG. This court is satisfied, Wozanski wrote, that the overriding real agreement of the Jersey Group, Standard, and IG was that these transfers, both of legal title and equitable interest, were to be null and void at the pleasure of IG, and the parties intended that after the close of World War II, the Jersey Group and IG would make whatever deal then deemed to be appropriate. Eisenhower, all smiles that he was. You have to give him credit. He saw through this. Eisenhower's specific recommendations as he took over the leadership at the close of the war was 1, make IG plants and other assets available for reparations. 2, destroy IG plants used exclusively for war-making purposes. 3, break up IG's monopoly control by dispersing ownership of the remaining plants. 4, terminate IG's interest in international cartels. And 5, take over IG's research programs and facilities. Same day, his recommendations were released. United States Army announced plans to dynamite 3 IG plants in the American zone. None of that came to pass. And for the next several years up to the Kennedys, IG reasserted its ownership and its partnership with Standard of New Jersey. But that's another a continuation of this subject. If you want me to continue, get on telephone. Now, the next section of this book plots the rebirth, particularly under the leadership of Schmidt, of IG Farben, under all of its camouflages, including the introduction after Nuremberg of bearer bonds for the company and its subsidiaries so that the ownership could be cloaked in anonymity, its rise to power in post-war Germany, and its eventual recovery of its properties in the United States. The formula made a very dramatic story out of this complicity. George C. Scott, if you'll remember, played the cop in it. And the Hollywoodization of the story was to have this chemist in Switzerland whose ego would not let the formula be hidden from the world lest credit not be given to those who conceived it. So he reveals in that movie, you recall, the formula so he doesn't die without the credit going the right place, as he viewed the right place. Now that's an addition. The oil companies know how to make synthetic gasoline. They don't want the formula working. With oil still in the ground, that earns the kind of profits they're used to earning. And with this kind of mess, through the ownership of America by multinational companies, is being repeated at a fearsome rate today. When 81% of the property in downtown Los Angeles is under foreign ownership today, he who doesn't know history is doomed to create the same mistakes. Now, in context of the teaching on the Lost Tribes, who was it that came in to save the remnant of these persecuted Jews? None other than their Celtic brethren. And as Scripture said, they would march to Israel and together go back to the Promised Land. It's all part of that prophecy. But that's on the subject of the Lost Tribes. The purpose of teaching tonight is to point out but another sewer under the surface of American history that the news media never worries enough about in their so-called devotion to the public's right to know. They think it's more interesting to show us George Bush casting into the sea and his anything but a bathing beauty wife splashing around in the water. And what they call hard news is Jimmy Swaggart and Jim Baker's dalliance that must be constantly exposed to save America from destruction. They make me sick. Now, the rest of this story catalogs up to the Kennedy years, the 15 to 20 years in the courts. Tied these assets up, exposed them in brief after brief, and created the stage for John F. Kennedy to say in a news conference, without mentioning the role his father played, that nobody was getting rich but attorneys, and the settlement that was arrived at was the best for all concerned. And the moral issues were buried beneath the stream of history. Stuff like this, and stuff like the Vatican Bank, make Jimmy Swaggart's poor little dalliance and his continual crying thereafter hardly worth the flick of an eyelid. Somebody needs to put the news media in perspective. They're a bunch of jerks, self-appointed demigods who are raping the American mind with their trivia, while real issues are not addressed. All I want to say, the gestalt of what I'm doing tonight, is the justification for their antics is a dedication to the so-called public's right to know. Well, it would seem to me the public has greater right to know things like this. Their dedication is extremely shallow. I'll probably get back to this as War and Remembrance brings the issue before us. But now I want you to go back to work. Now and on rerun. Get on the telephone. Right now. You know, I have a very intelligent audience. No matter what subject I get on, there are people that got there already. Santa Monica, does Dr. Scott know how many I.G. Farben research scientists were brought to the U.S. by our government to work here after the war? No, I don't know how many, but a lot of them. Torrance, this morning I was reading about the connection between Standard Oil and Farben. The books, The Rockefellers and American Dynasty, by Pete Collier and David Horowitz. I know that book. I got it in my library. I.G. Farben has regained control of Standard Oil, including oil reserves in Alaska. This information was stated on PBS program Saturday this week. William F. Buckley program. Interesting, isn't it? Somebody also said, I'm disappointed you read People. I don't read People magazine. I read People, but I don't read People magazine. Remember, I described the expression on the guy's face. I just happened to turn by when, I think it was Entertainment Tonight. They had the entertainment reporter from People magazine giving his review of War and Remembrance. And his biggest problem was, it's too long. Taxed his brain. I'm saying that. He didn't say that. Why aren't you reading from The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben? Schmitz was the master strategist in rebuilding the power of I.G. Farben. And after the court case in America settled that the so-called transfer was a camouflage, Schmitz had to start over again. In the fall of 1959, he was back in Basel to present his plan to Schaefer. The new power and the new entity that they would use was an entity called Interhandle, or camouflage. That was 59. The rebuilding continued right on up to the days of John F. Kennedy. The person in charge, Schmitz was the master planner, the person in charge of Interhandle was a man named Schaefer. Trips to the United States were turned loose, and some of them were fruitless. A month after one such fruitless visit by Schaefer to the United States, a friend and lawyer, a Dr. Gutstein, made a suggestion to him. We're quite a ways now from the war and from 1959. One of his clients was personally familiar with the new Democratic president. Why not ask this client to use his influence to arrange a meeting between Schaefer and the new Attorney General, Robert F. Kennedy? Schaefer readily agreed. Promptly after the meeting with Gutstein and his, quote, influential client, Schaefer wrote Spofford, another player, cryptically informing him that something important was afoot. I am pleased to tell you that we've been able to make a new contact with one of the highest authorities through the intermediary of a third party. I would ask you to treat this news very confidentially and hope I can report to you on further developments within a few days. My message will, however, probably be, again, private and personal. Spofford was in France on vacation, but Schaefer's letter was forwarded to him. Shortly thereafter, Spofford received a phone call from Orrick, and Orrick asked whether Spofford was aware that a new figure had come to the Justice Department of the United States on behalf of Interhandle. We're a long ways from Harding, too. Spofford admitted he was not. Orrick then dropped the bombshell. Prince Radziwill, he reported, was representing Interhandle. Spofford was jolted by the news. Radziwill was not even a lawyer, but he was the brother-in-law of President Kennedy. Would you like me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Of course, you know, news media thinks whatever Jimmy Baker did. And, you know, I'm greatly disturbed at the report I'm reading about the bankruptcy judge. Whatever opinion he wants to come down on about Jim Baker, I think it's a sad state of affairs in America when a jerk bankruptcy judge abuses his position on the bench by saying, since religion has entered into this case, a few quotes from Scripture are relevant. And then he quotes, the love of money is the root of all evil, and the one that's always taken out of context, be not deceived, whatsoever man soweth actually also reap. To what have we sunk in the passionate witch hunting against preachers? When a judge on an American bench designed to keep the separation between church and state nominates himself a preacher, an interpreter of scriptural exegesis, and includes it in his opinion. In the frame of War and Remembrance, I recall the statement, they came for the communists and I wasn't one of them, so I did nothing. They came for the socialists, and I wasn't one of them, so I did nothing. They came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't one of them, so I did nothing. They came for the Jew, and I wasn't one of them, so I did nothing. They came for me, and there was nobody left to do anything. When's America going to wake up to what the combined attack of a satanic, manipulated media, an anti-church government is doing to our religious freedoms? While such criminality as this remains unexposed to the American public. When you're seeing his last day prophecy being fulfilled, only a harlot church wed to the government in its evil designs will survive these last days. Except there is a protesting church that will keep Antichrist from being unveiled until that church be taken out of the way. And this may be the single most effective voice yet speaking in America and in the world today, which is why you ought to support it. So get on the telephone.